From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, does time really move forward? Is space empty? What lies beyond the reality that our senses can perceive? Is science in conflict with religion? These are some of the questions that physicist Brian Greene deals with in his new best-selling book, The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. His first bestseller, The Elegant Universe, was adapted into a PBS series which he hosted. Also today, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews new silent movie scores written and performed by the Alloy Orchestra, which you can hear on the DVDs of the Buster Keaton films The General and Steamboat Bill Jr. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush said today that the terrorist attacks in Madrid last week demonstrate the need for nations to stand together to continue to fight terrorism. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president, during a White House meeting with the Dutch prime minister, said these latest bombings are further evidence of the willingness of terrorists to kill innocent civilians anywhere.
They have not only killed in Spain, they've killed in the United States, they've killed in Turkey. They've killed in Saudi Arabia. They kill wherever they can. And it's essential that the free world remain strong and resolute and determined.
The president also said Spain should not withdraw its troops from Iraq, something the incoming Spanish prime minister says he will do. The president said Al-Qaeda wants efforts to bring democracy to Iraq to fail. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
Spanish police say they've arrested an Algerian man who allegedly threatened a terrorist attack in Madrid 2 months ago. At least five other suspects were arrested over the weekend. Meanwhile, the death toll in last week's bombing has risen to 201 as another victim died from his injuries. More than 1,600 people were wounded. The French Justice Ministry says it's investigating threats against France and French interests abroad from a previously known unknown Islamist group. In a letter to French newspapers, a group threatened France with terror if the government doesn't reverse itself on its ban on Muslim headscarves in public schools. The BBC's Carolyn Wyatt reports from Paris.
The French authorities say they are taking the threat seriously and investigating a previously unknown Islamist group, calling itself the Movsar Baraev Commando, apparently named after the Chechen hostage-taker killed at the end of the Moscow theatre siege. The group threatened to plunge France into terror, bloodshed and death if it didn't reverse a new law banning the wearing of the Islamic headscarf in schools, which is due to take effect in September. The one-and-a-half-page letter said France had thought it was immune from terror because it had opposed the war in Iraq. But now, the letter warned, France had directly attacked the Muslim community, and an attack on one Muslim was an attack against all.
The BBC's Carolyn Wyatt reporting from Paris. Israeli helicopters fired missiles into a house in Gaza City today, killing at least two people and wounding more than a dozen. The Israeli army said the attack was aimed at Islamic Jihad members. Palestinians said at least one of the dead was a member of the militant group, but that one may have been a passerby. The Israeli strike came just hours after the Israeli cabinet agreed to step up attacks on suspected Palestinian militants following Sunday's double suicide bombing in the Israeli port of Ashdod. In stocks, the Dow gained 81 to close at 10,184. The Nasdaq was up 3 to 1943. This is NPR News. The Federal Reserve meeting in Washington today has opted not to change short-term interest rates. That leaves the key federal funds rate where it's been since last June, at a 45-year low. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
In a unanimous decision, Fed policymakers voted to keep the federal funds rate, the rate banks charge one another for overnight loans, at 1%. And in a continuation of a statement it debuted back at its January meeting, the Fed said it believes it can be patient in deciding when it might have to start taking actions designed to ratchet rates back up again. However, the tone of the statement was also slightly less upbeat than the one issued at the conclusion of the Fed's last meeting. At that time, Alan Greenspan and others said indicators suggested an improving labor market. That was modified in this statement, the Fed saying although job losses have slowed, new hiring has lagged. The decision to leave the Fed funds rate unchanged means banks' prime lending rates, the rates they charge their best customers to borrow, will also hold steady at 4%, their lowest level in more than four decades. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Protesters demonstrated in the capital of Haiti today, calling for the return of ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The demonstration came as Aristide settles into temporary asylum in neighboring Jamaica. U.S. and Haitian officials are concerned that Aristide's proximity to Haiti may trigger further unrest among his supporters, but peacekeepers in the capital report that the situation was quiet overnight. Haiti's new prime minister has reportedly picked most of the cabinet members for his transitional government, but none are from Aristide's party. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 6 points to close at nearly 1,110. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Greene's new book begins with a number of provocative questions. Does time have a beginning? What does it mean for space to be empty? Can we manipulate space and time? What is reality? Greene is a physicist who has become well known for his ability to clearly explain some of the most challenging concepts of physics. He's also famous within his field for his discoveries in superstring theory. His book about string theory, The Elegant Universe, became a bestseller. His new book, already a bestseller, is called The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. It explains how modern science is revising our picture of reality, offering new theories about the world that exists beyond what we can perceive with our senses. You start the first chapter of your book not by quoting Einstein or Newton, but by quoting Camus. And you quote something he says at the beginning of The Myth of Sisyphus, which is, there is but one truly philosophical problem, and that is suicide. Why did you start your book on space and time and string theory with that quote about suicide?
Well, that particular quote I read when I was a teenager, and it really had a big influence on me because it very clearly, in very stark language, lays out what the most important question that we can ask ourselves is, and that's the question, is life worth living? Should we carry on this journey that we have been set upon? And in the years since reading that quote, it has really kind of framed the work that I've done because I've always felt that you can't answer that question, that key question, if you don't know what the context within which life takes place actually is. That is, if you don't know what the universe is, you don't really know what life is, and you don't know what is valuable in life. So I, for many years, have been trying to figure out with many colleagues around the world, you know, how the universe came to be, how it takes the form that we witness on a dark, starry night. In that way, just trying to get as clear a picture of the framework within which life takes place.
Now, what I love about your book, which I also find very unbalancing, is that your writing makes me disbelieve my senses. Because, as you say, the reality we observe may have little to do with the reality that's out there. So you're dealing with things that are way beyond our senses, in part because they're so microscopically small.
Yeah. I mean, that's really what science has been doing for the last 50 or 100 years. I mean, there was a time, if you go back to the time of Newton, when the key questions had to do with the things that you do see in everyday life. You know, Newton apocryphally was looking at, you know, apples falling from trees or the motion of the moon around the earth, things that you could see with your eyes. But basically, the success that we've had at describing everyday phenomena using the laws of physics has impelled us, driven us to go further. And when we have gone further to try to understand the microscopic structure of matter, molecules and atoms and subatomic particles, the shocking thing is physics has revealed that the familiar world operates according to principles that just don't apply in the micro world. The micro world is very bizarre. It's very strange. And it kind of morphs into the familiar everyday world when things get larger. But if you or I were to live in the micro world, if we were to shrink our bodies, by a factor of 100 billion billion and walk around in the micro world, it would be more bizarre than any science fiction that you've ever seen. It is very odd and very strange by everyday standards.
Let's get back to the idea that the reality we observe may have little to do with the reality that's out there. And let's apply that to time. Now, my reality is that my watch ticks away time second by second, and that time in my reality is always moving forward. It never moves backward except in memory. And it moves forward in predictable ways in 24-hour days, although some days seem longer and some days feel shorter depending on how well the day is going. Okay, but scientists have challenged this idea of the forward arrow of time. What is the theory that that challenges that time just moves forward in a predictable way?
Well, scientists haven't completely challenged the idea that time has a forward arrow associated with it. What they have puzzled over, though, is something tightly related to that, which is why does it have a forward arrow associated with it? I mean, after all, for instance, space, you're able to move left or right. You can move back or forth. You seem to have complete freedom to navigate space. Why don't you have the same freedom to navigate time? Why does time seem to relentlessly point toward what we conventionally call the future? Now, the strange thing is that when you study the laws of physics, there's no orientation when it comes to time that is fundamentally embedded in the laws of physics. In other words, the future and the past, according to the equations that Newton wrote down, or the equations that Einstein wrote down, or the equations of quantum theory, all of those equations treat past and future on completely equal footing, completely symmetrically. But yet our experience is completely asymmetric. The past is behind us and gone. The future is yet to be. This is our intuition. Where does that experience come from if the laws of physics don't seem to have an arrow of time built into them? That's the question that we have studied. And we've made a lot of progress, I think, in trying to come to an answer. The surprising thing, we can go through the chain of reasoning if you'd like, is that the reasoning leads us to the Big Bang itself. We believe that special conditions at the birth of the universe imprinted a direction on time, and we have been living through the unfolding of that arrow of time that was launched, if you will, by the Big Bang itself.
Well, do you think about things like time travel, like if we'll ever be able to move forward in time and see the future before the future happens, or move backward in time and visit the past?
Well, time travel is a very provocative idea, and it really is very important to distinguish between two kinds of time travel to the future and time travel to the past. And the reason why you need to make that distinction is time travel to the future is not part of science fiction. It really emerges from insights that Einstein had in the early part of the 20th century. Time travel to the future is within the laws of physics as we understand it. If you want to see what, say, the Earth will be like 1,000 years from now, or 10,000, or even 1,000,000 years from now, Einstein lays out a strategy for doing it. You build a spaceship, you travel out into space at very high speed, near the speed of light, you turn around and you come back. And if you carried out that journey correctly, when you return to Earth, perhaps 1 year will have elapsed according to your biology and according to the clocks in your ship. But when you step out of your spaceship, 1,000 years or 10,000 or 1,000,000 years will have gone by on Earth. You will have leaped into Earth's future through this particular journey. Now, we can't actually build the ships that can go near the speed of light, so we can't actually carry out this kind of journey today, or perhaps ever, I don't know. But in terms of the laws of physics, traveling to the future is absolutely within those laws.
What about traveling to the past?
Well, that's, of course, the key thing. Let's say, you know, someone gives the opportunity and you do travel to the future. Can you get back? And most of us believe that you can't. Most of us believe that time travel to the past is just on a very different par than travel to the future. You know, the reason is something that we're all very familiar with. There are all sorts of paradoxes that arise if you can travel to the past. You know, you can imagine traveling to the past and doing something that would prevent your own birth. Then how are you there to actually carry out that act if you were never born in the first place? There are paradoxes of this sort. Now, these paradoxes, it turns out there are ways around them, some very cute and interesting ways around them, from quantum theory in particular. But our gut feeling is that when the laws of physics are fully understood, time travel to the past will not be possible. But I should say, you know, as of today, some very well-respected physicists have even suggested ways that you might build a time machine that would allow you to travel to the past. When you study the proposals in detail, they seem to all kind of brush right up against the limits of the currently known laws of physics. And most of us believe that when those laws are better understood, the proposals will actually pierce them and step outside the laws of physics and thereby be impossible. But as of today, no one's been able to prove that. And that's at least kind of compelling and provocative.
My guest is physicist Brian Greene. His new book is called The Fabric of the Cosmos. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is physicist Brian Greene. His new bestseller is called The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. Since your new book is about time and space, let's talk a little bit about space. We think of space, we lay people think of space as being empty, you know, just kind of like devoid of anything. Maybe like there's air or there's not air or there's some particles floating around. But how do you think of space? Do you think of it as emptiness or something else?
Yeah, very different. This is one of the key ways in which I think common perception misleads us. And maybe as an aside, I should emphasize, I don't think it's surprising that common perception will mislead us because our perceptions evolved through many centuries, through many millennia, in order that we can survive in the jungle. And perceptions that are good at making us survive are not necessarily good at revealing the true nature of the world. True nature of the universe. That's why we need to go further with our minds and experiments and our equations. And when we do that, especially with regard to space, we come to a very different picture of space than the intuitive one that you just described. Because, for instance, according to quantum mechanics and this so-called Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which is a principle that says that there are always features of the microworld that are undetermined, that can fluctuate between various possibilities. And what that means when you apply it to space is that there is no such thing as truly empty space. Even in what you normally think of as the deep darkness of empty space, no planets, no stars, no galaxies, totally dark, quantum theory says that there's always, in the microscopic feature of that space, particles popping into existence and then annihilating, fields like the electromagnetic field fluctuating up and down. So in the microworld, there is this tumult, this chaos, this frenzied activity that even happens in the deep darkness of what we normally think of as completely empty space. So the very notion of nothingness is completely rewritten by the laws of quantum physics.
Well, you know, if the world is filled with dimensions that our senses don't allow us to perceive, you could argue that, you know, some or all of those dimensions are the world of microparticles. But I guess you could also argue just as easily that that world is a more spiritual one in which we see, you know, spiritual forces that in which there exist spiritual forces that we are incapable of perceiving.
I would dissuade people from heading in that direction. Let me tell you why. Mm-hmm. Indeed, string theory is the theory that I work on, one of the cutting edge developments in an attempt to build what Einstein called a unified theory, a theory that might describe everything in the world using one basic master equation. And this approach called string theory does entail that the universe have more than the three dimensions that we know about. So we all know about left, right, back, forth, up, down. This theory does say that there are other dimensions beyond those. And since we don't see them, many people might say, well, perhaps they are on par with some of the mystical ideas or theological ideas. And the main difference and the key distinction to keep in mind is when we talk about these extra dimensions, we haven't been able to do it yet, but we ultimately imagine that we will make predictions for how these dimensions behave and the implications that these dimensions have for observable phenomenon. And that's the key difference between the scientific incarnation of these strange ideas and the mystical incarnation. We only will believe these ideas when we can test them experimentally. There's no act of faith that's going to be involved in our taking on the theories that we are studying. And I don't think that's true of either the theological or mystical approaches, which always, as far as I have encountered so far, involve some element of faith and a key inability to make predictions that will be testable and allow us to determine whether those ideas are right or wrong.
What's wrong with faith? What's wrong with just believing something because you have faith, even though it isn't empirically provable or testable?
Nothing's wrong with it at all. In fact, my brother is a Hare Krishna. And for many years, the developments that we've come upon in physics and string theory, I always enjoy telling him about these developments. And a lot of the time he'll say to me, well, we already knew that. That's in Vedic text number 23 or something of that sort. And, you know, it's an interesting exchange because when we've ever gone into more detail on it, it seems as though many of the ideas that we have come upon do have a kind of resonance with ideas that have been articulated in ancient texts or even in more modern theological or mystical texts. And I think that's very interesting. But from the point of view of what we really believe as true from the scientific perspective, we have laid down over the last few centuries a particular yardstick to determine what we believe and what we don't believe. And from the scientific point of view, that yardstick involves making a prediction that an experimenter can go out and measure and determine whether your prediction is right or wrong. If your prediction is confirmed, your ideas are right. If your prediction is not borne out by the experiment, your ideas are plain wrong. And we have found this to be a very fruitful way to describe the universe. We have got very deep ideas, which are now describing the world and able to make predictions. Now, it's not to say that that yardstick is the right one outside of science. You know, when it comes to religion and mystical ideas, maybe faith is the right yardstick. But the key thing to bear in mind is you're not going to be able to really make a prediction. You're not going to be able to say how the universe truly works if you're not, at least as far as I've seen in any example, working in the scientific context where experiment is the yardstick.
Do you think that science necessarily conflicts with religion and vice versa?
Not at all. I mean, oftentimes people do talk about this conflict between science and religion. And look, if you want to stop teaching evolution and start teaching creationism, then yeah, there's a conflict. But I don't consider the overarching realms of science and religion to be in conflict because, for instance, it could be that everything that I'm doing as a scientist and everything that every other scientist is doing is simply revealing the laws that were laid down by some divine being. This is absolutely possible. And in fact, if you think about it, there's no way ever for science to disprove that possibility because the retort can always be, well, the divine being set it up so that you would describe things and make that argument to try to disprove what the divine being set in place. So it's completely unfalsifiable that what we're doing might be revealing God's design. And to tell you the truth, if that's what we're doing, I think it's pretty cool. I'd be very excited to spend my life trying to work out the laws that the divine being set down. Now, I should say, I see no evidence for a divine being. I see no evidence for anything but the laws of physics. And again, if there is no divine being and what we're doing is revealing laws that have described how the universe began and how it's going to evolve for 100 billion years into a future, I think that's pretty cool too, and I'm excited to try to work out those laws unto themselves.
What's your reaction to the people who believe that evolution should not be taught in the schools, but creationism should, or that creationism should be taught alongside evolution, or that something called intelligent design should be taught, and if I comprehend intelligent design correctly, that is the theory that the universe is so complicated that there had to be some kind of master intelligence behind it, and the implication at least is that master intelligence is God. What's your reaction to that whole conflict?
Well, I find it highly unfortunate and very dangerous when one tries to substitute religious ideas for scientific breakthrough and scientific developments. Again, you know, I think if one is taking a course on religion and theology, then I think it's very interesting to study what the ancient religions have said about the universe and how it came into being and so forth. But my own feeling is, and I think this is shared by many people, at least I hope it is, that science has given us such new, deep insight into the workings of the world. I mean, we can understand, by and large, how it is that the universe is expanding. We can understand, by and large, how it is that galaxies formed, how stars form. We understand the nuclear processes that allow our sun to shine and bathe the earth in radiation and heat and light, and to try to substitute something for the powerful science that we've developed to understand these things is a travesty. Again, you know, I feel that it's not the point of science to rule out that perhaps everything we do fits inside some religious context, but no way should we allow older religious ideas to somehow displace the fantastic developments that science has achieved over many years. In fact, let me just say it this way. There's a way of thinking about religion where when you can't address something in the natural world, you try to bring in God or some religious explanation because you haven't yet figured it out. And that is often called God of the gaps. We use God to fill in the gaps in our understanding. And from that point of view, the more we understand, the more God is necessarily going to get pushed out. Because the more we understand how the world came to be and how life evolved and formed, we're not going to need the theological explanation. And I think there are some people who feel that religion is diminished by being pushed out from that explanatory role. But what we as scientists will never do is give an answer to why there is a universe and the meaning of the universe and the meaning of life. And I think that many people, not me, but many people do find religion is very, very effective at answering those why questions. So my feeling is we should use science in the realm that science works well to answer the how questions, and we should perhaps, if it's one's particular taste, use religion to answer the why questions.
Brian Greene is the author of the new bestseller, The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback by Eric Larson, Devil in the White City, Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair That Changed America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the discovery that space can rip and how scientists figured it out. We continue our conversation with physicist Brian Greene. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews the Alloy Orchestra's new movie scores for Buster Keaton's silent films.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with physicist Brian Green, author of the new bestseller, The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. It discusses the latest scientific theories about the nature of space, time, and the reality beyond what we can perceive with our senses. It explains many complicated ideas, but can't answer how I got this annoying cold. Fortunately, we recorded the interview before I came down with it. Anyway, when we left off, we were comparing how science and religion go about explaining some of the same questions about the nature of the universe. As a physicist who's very interested in the creation of the universe and the implications of the Big Bang theory, can you talk a little bit about the creation story from the physicist's point of view?
Yeah, so from the point of view of physics, the creation story, if we use that language, is often described as the Big Bang. And the key thing that many people are not aware of is that the Big Bang is a theory of how the universe evolved from a split second after whatever occurred to bring it into existence. And we definitely are still struggling to figure out what happened at time zero. Our equations, general relativity, breaks down when we try to apply it literally to time zero itself. We can only go far back as about, you know, a fraction of a second, you know, 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the beginning. And that's where our story begins. We don't start at the very, very start. And the idea is that in the very beginning, the universe, all of space, all of time, in fact, it was all compressed to an ultra-microscopic nugget, very, very tiny. Now, this is not a nugget that exists within space. This is all of space crushed together. Then the universe begins to expand. Space expands. It goes outwards. And as the universe expands, it cools down. It was very hot in the beginning. It gets cooler and cooler and cooler as space expands. And as it cools down, structures can begin to congeal out of this primordial hot plasma. And that structures begins to form, and it yields ultimately galaxies and stars, and other things form out of the plasma, planets, and ultimately the things that we see on our Earth. So there are a lot of mathematical details in that progression over 14 billion years, but that's, in a nutshell, our understanding of how the universe takes the form that it currently does.
It's so difficult to imagine the whole universe being a kind of particle, not a particle within the universe, but the whole universe is that one particle. And then you start wondering, well, what's around the particle? If there's nothing around the particle, it's kind of unfathomable. It's
very hard because you're right. I mean, any object that we look at exists within space.
Exactly.
And therefore, there's space around it. And what we are asking you to do is to imagine that all of space itself is crushed to this very, very small size so that there wouldn't necessarily be anything outside of it. You know, it's very hard to picture. Analogies sometimes help. I don't know if this one will do it for you, but we often invoke the so-called balloon analogy, where we imagine that all of space is the surface of a balloon. Now, for this analogy to work, you can't think about what's in the balloon, outside the balloon. Think of the surface of a balloon as the entire universe. And when the balloon is very, very, very tiny, space will therefore be very small. As you begin to blow air into the balloon will expand and get bigger and bigger. And that expansion is quite analogous to the expansion or stretching of space. Now, the surface of the balloon gets bigger and bigger without it necessarily requiring a realm to expand into. Now, that's hard to picture because we always think of the balloon in a room and it's getting bigger within the room. But imagine that the surface of the balloon is everything. There's nothing else in this balloon universe but its surface. And as its surface stretches, you get more balloon, more space. Similarly, as our universe expands, you get more space. It doesn't require pre-existing space. The expansion itself creates the new space itself.
You've co-discovered a couple of big things in the world of physics. Would you tell us about one of them, maybe the one that's simpler to explain?
Sure. I've worked for many years on the spatial dimensions that string theory requires and came upon something a couple of years ago which was very interesting, very exciting. So in Einstein's general relativity, as we've sort of discussed already, the theory says that space can expand. In fact, it says other things. It says space can stretch, it can twist, it can warp, it can undergo all sorts of changes in shape over time. But the one thing that general relativity says cannot happen, it says that space can't rip. Now, if you take any familiar piece of material, you stretch it enough, it will tear. general relativity says that's a failure of the analogy, that when it comes to space, you can keep on stretching it. It will never rip. Now, we studied this question in string theory, which is a theory that goes beyond Einstein's general theory of relativity by also incorporating quantum mechanics. And we re-asked that question, can space rip? And in the framework of string theory, we found that indeed space can tear. Space can literally rip apart without there being any catastrophe, without there being any explosion or anything like that. Space can rip and repair itself in a manner that Einstein would not have thought possible. So in essence, what we learned is that space can evolve through a sequence of changes that are much more exotic than the ones that Einstein would have thought possible in the 20th century.
So if space rips, what does that mean exactly? So if a fabric rips, you can stick your finger through it. If space rips, what gets through the space? What's on one side of the tear and what's on the other side of the tear?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because you might say, well, if it rips, is the space in the in between the two pieces? Is that part of the universe or is that outside of the universe? And the answer is that there isn't any in between the two pieces, because again, we're talking about the entire universe. We're talking about all of space. And what we're simply learning is that the changes in the shape of space are more exotic than what we thought before. So were you at the edge of the rip, so to speak? It's not as though you could fall out into some abyss. No, it just means that that piece of space would be connected to a different part at the end of this process than it would have been connected to at the start of this process. So it's simply an evolution in the shape of space that previously would have been ruled out, but now is allowed by these more refined laws of string theory.
My guest is physicist Brian Greene. His new book is called The Fabric of the Cosmos. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Brian Greene. His new bestseller is called The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. Greene is a physicist who has made discoveries in the area of string theory. Can I ask you to give us a layperson's explanation of what string theory is?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So string theory, well, first let me just say what it attempts to do, and then I'll say what the theory actually is. String theory attempts to realize the dream that Albert Einstein himself articulated in 1930s, 1940s of finding this unified theory, is what he called it, the single theory to describe everything. And at that time, Einstein was really kind of, somewhat of an outcast among scientists, because no one else really believed that this was a worthy goal or it was a goal that was attainable. So he kind of worked in solitude for many years. It was a very sort of sad end to the career of the perhaps greatest physicist of all time, because he worked very hard to find this unified theory, but he never found it. Now, we think that string theory, this new approach, may well be the theory that Einstein was looking for, a theory that does unify everything together. Now, how does it do that? Well, the basic question that string theory seeks to address is, what is the smallest constituent making up matter in the world around us? So just to be concrete, imagine you took a piece of wood and you sliced it in half, slice that piece in half again, keep on cutting into ever smaller pieces. A natural question is, where does it stop or does it stop? Is there a finest ingredient that you get to in this cutting process? Now, we've learned in our age that sooner or later in this cutting process, you get way down to the scale of molecules and atoms. But we also have learned that atoms are not the end of the story, because they can be cut, they can be split into little electrons that orbit around the nucleus, which has neutrons and protons, and even those particles can be split up because they have finer constituents that are known as quarks. Now, that is where conventional theory and experiment stops. Electrons and these little particles called quarks and a few other exotic species are the fundamental entities making up everything, you, me, tables, everything in the world that we can literally see. String theory comes along and says no. It suggests that the story continues. It suggests that there's at least one more level of structure. So it says that if you were to look inside an electron or look inside a quark, you would see something else. And the something else is a little filament, little filament of vibrating energy. It kind of looks like a string. That's where the name string theory comes from. And the wonderful idea is that just as the string on a violin can vibrate in different patterns that your ear will hear as different musical notes, these little strings in string theory also can vibrate in different patterns. The vibrations don't produce music. Instead, they produce the different particle species. So an electron is a string vibrating, say, like a middle C, and a quark is a string vibrating like an A. So everything in the world, according to string theory, comes from one fundamental idea, the vibrations of these little strings, these little filaments of energy. That's the basic idea.
And somehow the discovery or the posing of this string theory leads to the possibility that there are other dimensions beyond the dimensions that we are capable of perceiving.
Yes.
How does string theory lead to the possibility of other dimensions?
Very tough question to answer without mathematics. Mm-hmm. So let me just say it briefly, and then I'll maybe just fill it in with more of a technical statement. But the underlying mathematics of string theory says that the math breaks down. It doesn't make sense unless these strings can vibrate in a certain number of patterns. Now imagine you have a little string on your tabletop. It can vibrate in, say, the left, right, and back, forth dimensions on the tabletop, but that's it. If you constrain it to vibrate only on the surface of the table. Now allow the string to also vibrate in the up-down direction. Clearly, there'll be more vibrational patterns that can be executed, the ones that you had before, plus these new ones that might go in the up-down direction. Now the thing is, when we count up the number of vibrational patterns in a universe with three dimensions, there aren't enough to satisfy the equations of string theory. When we look in a universe that, say, has four dimensions, indeed, now we have more vibrational patterns. It's hard to picture, but the more dimensions there are, the more vibrational patterns there are allowable. There aren't enough in four dimensions to meet the equations of string theory. We keep on going. And finally, when we hit the 10-dimensional universe, the number of vibrational patterns of a string does match the requirement that comes out of the math of string theory. And that's where we get this strange prediction that the universe doesn't have three dimensions, but it has more. It comes from the internal mathematical consistency of the equations of the theory itself.
Well, I think all I can say to that is wow.
Yeah. Well, I have to tell you, that's what physicists said. This was completely unexpected. People were studying the physics of strings, and they came upon this equation. And the equation, for the first time, I should say, in the history of physics, was not an equation for some process in the universe. It was an equation that dictated the number of dimensions of space. And the absolute mind-blowing, strange thing was, when people studied the equation, it did not say that there are three dimensions of space. It said there are more. And that was very, very unexpected and very mind-blowing.
What are the tools that you use to pose questions about another dimension?
Well, we do thought experiments. We can't, at the moment, build technology that would actually allow us to probe these extra dimensions, again, assuming the theory is correct. So we pose thought experiments. We ask ourselves, imagine that the extra dimensions have a particular shape. Think of it as a ball or a donut or any particular shape that the equations allow. And we ask ourselves, for instance, what would happen if the shape of the extra dimensions were to slowly change? Would there be something that we could observe in the world around us that would change in a corresponding manner? And indeed, we have found, for instance, that the mass of a particle like the electron would slowly shift if the extra dimensions change their shape slowly, or the strength of the electromagnetic force or the strength of gravity might slowly shift if these extra dimensions changed. And we spent many years trying to make a very precise dictionary between the shapes of these extra dimensions and the physics of the particles that we would observe. If you like, I can spell that out a touch more concretely.
Sure.
When a string vibrates, its vibrational pattern, as I was saying, determines the properties of particles. So, for instance, if a string vibrates really fast, it has a lot of energy. And from Einstein's E equals MC squared, that means the corresponding particle would have a lot of mass. If a string vibrates very gently, the energy will be less, so the particle will have less mass, and so forth. Now, when a string vibrates, it doesn't just vibrate into the three dimensions around us. A string is so tiny that it also vibrates into the extra dimensions. And just as the air that goes through a French horn goes into vibrational patterns that are influenced by the twists and turns in the French horn, the vibrational patterns of a string are influenced by the twists and turns in the geometry of these extra dimensions. And that means that properties in the world around us, like the mass of the electron or the strength of the forces of nature, may well be determined by the shape of the extra dimensions. So it's not a matter of hiding away the extra dimensions, making them very small because we can't see them. They may have a very direct impact on the world around us.
What did you fall in love with first, a search for, like, meaning in the world or just a passion for numbers and the beauty of numbers themselves?
It was definitely numbers. When I was a little kid, I was amazed by the fact that, you know, my dad taught me the elementary operations, addition, you know, division, multiplication, and so forth. And I was amazed by the fact that with these few rules, you could then start to do stuff. You could do calculations, maybe a calculation that nobody had done before. And I think that's really what's very compelling about numbers and about mathematics. I mean, you see it. We are aware of there being, you know, mathematical prodigies, but do you ever have a prodigy in history or psychology or English literature? No, because those subjects, you require maturity. You require experience to excel. But in mathematics, you teach a kid a few operations, and he or she can go off and running and do stuff. And that's what I did as a kid, you know. I started to do these calculations that my dad would set me, maybe to keep him out of his hair or something. And I would spend days and days doing these huge multiplications and calculations, often for no real purpose beyond the wonder of the numbers themselves.
Now, your father was a former vaudevillian. Do I have that right?
Yeah. My dad was.
What was his act?
Well, he used to be part of a harmonica act when he was much younger.
Not the Harmonicats.
No. It was a much less well-known group, and he was also a stand-up comedian. He was also a voice teacher. He was Harry Belafonte's vocal coach, actually. So Harry Belafonte would often come to our house, our apartment in Manhattan when I was growing up to take lessons. So it was a very musical environment when I was growing up, but it was also a difficult one because, I mean, as you know, as many people know, the music industry is very hard to succeed. And my dad, who spent much of his time composing, you know, wrote a lot of music that never saw the light of day. And it was hard to see this creative person, very talented creative person, whose work basically just would gather dust. So it was very hard in many ways.
Are you interested in the physics of music, you know, the vibrations of notes and instruments and all that?
Well, I love the fact that the analogies that physicists have used for many years, which are often musical, we talk about the music of the spheres, we talk about, you know, vibrations and so forth, the fact that these metaphors are, they find their most natural home in string theory, you know, the theory that I work on, because the strings in string theory, the equations really are very similar to the equations of a violin string. I mean, there are sort of key differences, but roughly speaking, they're in the same genre of equations. And the fact, therefore, that the analogy of music really brushes up so closely to the physics I discuss and work on is very satisfying. It sort of brings it all in a full circle for me.
Well, I'd like to end on a note about string theory, getting back to the idea that string theory allows for the possibility, in fact, suggests the possibility that there are other dimensions beyond our perception. Could you just, like, leave us with some idea of what one of those dimensions might be or how these extra dimensions might affect us, if at all, once we discover them?
Yeah, well, if the extra dimensions are of the sort that we think about, I think that they may give an answer to what many people think is the deepest question that a scientist can ask, which is this: why is the universe as it is? So experimenters for 100 years have gone out and measured the numbers that I've mentioned before, like the mass of the electron or the strength of gravity, the strength of the electromagnetic force. And there are about 20 numbers of that sort that very, very talented experimenters have measured. We have the numbers and we can write them down. The thing is, nobody knows why the particular numbers have the values that they do. We don't know why the electron weighs what it does. Now, you might say, who cares? You know, if it weighed a little more, it weighed a little less, so be it. That's just how the world would be. But you really should care, because it turns out that if you change any of those numbers by even a little bit, the universe as we know it would disappear. The universe has stars, which rely upon nuclear processes that demand delicate relationships between those numbers. You fiddle with those numbers, you change the nuclear processes, they don't happen, stars don't light up, the universe as we know it blacks out, it completely disappears. So the deep question is, why do the 20 numbers have just the right values to allow stars to shine, planets to form, and people to exist at least one planet? Now, no theory has answered this question. String theory hasn't. But it has proposed a framework, and the framework relies upon the extra dimensions. Because as I mentioned before, string vibrations, we believe, are the answer to why those numbers have the values they do. The strings vibrate into the extra dimensions. So if we knew exactly what the extra dimensions look like, we don't know them yet, but if we did, we might be able to calculate how the strings would vibrate, and that way calculate the 20 numbers. And if the answer that we got for those 20 numbers agreed with the numbers that experimenters have found over the last century, that really would be the first fundamental explanation for why the universe is as it is, and it would rely upon the extra dimensions. So that really is what we're shooting for, trying to explain how it is that the world around us takes the form that it does, and it may very well invoke those extra dimensions in string theory.
Well, Brian Greene, thank you. Very interesting. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Brian Greene is the author of the new bestseller, The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews the Alloy Orchestra's new scores for Buster Keaton's silent films. This is Fresh Air. Silent movies were never really silent. They were always accompanied by music. Most of the original music has been lost. One of the pioneers in composing new music for old movies is the Alloy Orchestra. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz thinks they do just about everything music for a silent movie needs to do, and more.
A few weeks ago, I was part of a sold-out crowd having the time of its life at a silent movie, a screening of Buster Keaton's great Civil War comedy, The General. Part of the attraction was the live accompaniment, perfectly synchronized by the amazing Alloy Orchestra, a group that both composes and performs its own music. This orchestra is actually a trio. Terry Donahue on junk percussion and accordion, Roger C. Miller on synthesizer, and Ken Winokur playing percussion and clarinet. They provide atmosphere, comic, romantic, or ominous, and especially changes of mood. They also provide sound effects, a train whistle, a bird call, a marching band, a rifle shot. They can reinforce a sight gag or underline the punchline of a joke. Bada-boom! Two of the Alloy Orchestra's best scores are for Buster Keaton's masterpieces The General and Steamboat Bill Jr. The General is one of the most complexly ironic treatments of American heroism in film. The title is the name of the train run by the Keaton character, Johnny Gray, a Confederate Army rejectee. He's good at his job, not only competent, but imaginative. Yet he's also a klutz, who can be most successful when he's most inept. At one point, he pulls his sword out of its sheath, and the blade comes loose and flies into the air. But when it lands, it kills his most dangerous enemy. Without diminishing the comedy, the music is also truly heroic, evoking the grandeur and tragedy of the Civil War, in what was the closest Keaton came to producing an epic. The merging of the two main themes, The riveting train music and the visceral war music is chilling. One of the great Keaton moments comes in Steamboat Bill Jr. A hurricane is ravaging the town. Keaton is standing in front of a house when the whole front wall collapses on him. Miraculously, he's standing directly under an open window. Keaton was legendary for doing his own stunts. The wall could have killed him if it landed only inches to the left or right. In some screenings, though, that 2-ton wall doesn't look very heavy, maybe because the film speed is a little off. If the wall comes down just the slightest bit too fast or too slow, it seems weightless. On the new DVD from Image, the projection speed has been corrected, and the Alloy Orchestra provides just the subtlest little drum thud when the falling wall hits the ground. I've never seen a version in which the weight of the wall, the danger to Keaton, is so completely realized. Most silent movie music just fills the void. Some of it even gets in the way. But the Alloy Orchestra really helps us see what we're watching. And often the music, whether driving or fanciful, is even worth listening to on its own.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the Alloy Orchestra, which can be heard accompanying silent movies on DVDs released by Image Entertainment and Kino. In the next few months, the Alloy Orchestra will be performing in Detroit, Boston, Winston-Salem, Baltimore, and New York, and at the Ozark Foothills Film Festival, the San Francisco Film Festival, and Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Death and Life of Charlie St. Cloud, a novel about one man's quest for love and meaning by Ben Sherwood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Hans Blix. He headed the UN commission that conducted weapons inspections in Iraq. He's written a new memoir called Disarming Iraq. We'll talk about the inspections process, his views on the war in Iraq, and the WMD threats we face today. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.